Welcome to the gala Chelsea Clinton Gets Married edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin without an invitation.
Oh, you didn't get one.
I got something in the mail yesterday that said occupant, so I thought, but that was for me. That's the only mail I ever get.
That's okay. That makes sense.
Did you, Ron, get an invitation?
I got something from Hillary Clinton. But it turned out to be a long-delayed fundraising appeal.
Please pay off my 2008 campaign debt.
And that, I don't think, included, although I shook it pretty hard, it did not include an invitation to Chelsea's wedding.
Mark Mezvinsky, the son of two former members of Congress.
That's correct.
From what states?
Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Marjorie Margolis
Mezvinsky,
right. His mother. And Mr. Mezvinsky from New York.
Close.
New Jersey.
Close. Right.
Iowa. I was testing you.
Ed Mezvinsky, who was on the House Judiciary Committee during Watergate, who was defeated by Jim Leach in 76.
And like just that. This past week, we noted the 36th anniversary of the vote of the House Judiciary Committee to impeach President Nixon.
Everything comes full circle in Rhinebeck, New York this weekend.
That's right. Lots of people going to Rhinebeck from Arkansas, but not so many from Arizona.
Well, fewer and fewer may be deported from Arizona because Judge Bolton seems to have thrown out a lot of the Arizona law that seemed to be the most controversial.
All of the main provisions.
Everything.
Yeah, although the rest of the law did go into effect this very day, as we talk.
But what's in the law now that police cannot ask for proof of citizenship?
Well, there is actually very little left in the law that would be of any kind of controversy at all. All of the constitutional issues have been thrown out by Judge Bolton and will now be tested at ever higher levels.
Probably
of the
Supreme Court, yeah.
That's correct, of the federal judicial system. First the appellate court level and then probably on to the Supremes. And this will probably be going on for at least another year, wouldn't
well,
you think?
Well, let's talk about it in political terms in 2010. With it gone, is it still an advantage for the Republicans?
I think with the law no longer clearly going into effect, so we don't get a test and we don't have a lot of, you know, random news stories about effects of the law, it may have a little less edge. On the other hand, it seems to me it makes an excellent talking point for many Republicans to say, we tried to do something because the Obama administration and the Democrats in Congress had not tackled the program at the national level. So we tried to do something in Arizona. And what do? They send their Justice Department to sue, and they get one of their federal judges to throw the law out.
Governor Jan Brewer, of course, said she will appeal. And as you say, it'll probably go to the Supreme Court. The likely Democratic candidate, Terry Goddard, the attorney general.
That is governor candidate running against Jan Brewer.
Right, exactly. Whose father was a governor back in the 1960s, Sam Goddard. He has actually been on the fence of it. He said he didn't want the Justice Department coming in and appealing it, but he didn't like the law to begin with. But Governor Brewer's argument still is that Arizona took this step because the federal government failed to act in immigration policy.
That's right. And another thing that the Congress has not done that has been before them for a number of months, they have not passed anything with respect to campaign finance since the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court allowed much more freedom of funding of campaigns for corporations and unions last winter. And there was an act specifically written, has probably the silliest name of any bill that I've seen come to the floor of the Senate in a very long time. Its acronym is DISCLOSE. So the purpose of the bill is to force the disclosure of the source of funds for any kind of campaign, which is in and of itself not a silly proposition.
No, and you know, disclose makes the man. But the Republican argument has been that the Democrats are trying to change the law in the middle of the campaign that it protects the Democratic majority.
But they have never, to my knowledge, addressed the contradiction of their suddenly opposing disclosure, simple disclosure, not a limitation, not saying you can't give, just saying you have to identify the sources.
Charles Schumer and the Democrats from day one, from the moment in January when Supreme Court ruled on Citizens United, they said, well, look, we've got to do there's got to be some kind of a congressional response to this. And they feel that, look, we probably can't battle the fact that corporations and unions will spend whatever they can, but at least let's know where it comes from.
Right. Let's not let people make ads and put ads on TV and then identify the source of the ad as Citizens United for Good Things or People United for America. Let's make them say we're actually the Exxon Corporation or we're actually the Service Employees International or we're actually the AFL-CIO.
Right. And the reason they couldn't get a vote in the Senate is because the Democrats seem stuck on 59 votes. I assume that's a number that'll get lower after November. We keep talking about the importance of having 60 votes. Well, here's one example where 60 votes the lack of 60 votes. The Democrats only have 59 right now. The lack of 60 votes is really what kept this from coming up for a vote.
So as long as we're flirting with this 60 number, as long as the Democrats are close to it, the Republicans feel that they almost have to vote en bloc, so that in anything other than, say, unemployment benefits or something of that nature, or the final financial regulations bill, it's impossible to bring any Republicans over, even on something that many Republicans would prefer to be voting for. But they hang together because they see that as their ability in a reduced minority state to still have their say about legislation and to still block legislation if they choose.
And interestingly enough, it was the Republicans who supplied the most votes for the funds to wage the war in Afghanistan, the bill that the House passed this week. Most Republicans, there were only like 12 Republicans who voted no on it. Everybody else on the Republican side voted yes. The Democratic caucus was really split.
Down the middle.
And I was, I think it was like 148 to 102, something like that. But I was very interested to see if the leaked documents from WikiLeaks was going to make Democrats more skittish about voting for the war, a war that looks less and less winnable.
It looks less and less winnable, has for some while. It's certainly less and less popular. But the Republicans have almost no other issue on which they do agree with the president. And this is the biggest one on which they have pushed the president to go further in the direction he's going, that is committing to the war in Afghanistan. So you got a little bit more of a bipartisan split. But on every other piece of major legislation, the parties have lined up against each other almost to a person in a fashion I can't remember seeing in Washington before.
Well, look at what's coming up. You know, the Elena Kagan nomination for the Supreme Court. Only four, as of this podcast, only four Republicans have come out in favor of Elena Kagan, which is even far fewer than what Sotomayor got last year.
That's right. And Elena Kagan will be confirmed. The Republicans have not chosen to filibuster her nomination. That was a decision they apparently came to some months ago, that it would be unpopular to filibuster against a Supreme Court nominee against whom they had no real issue, but they're still going to vote against her.
So the Democrats are getting their way on some votes. They'll certainly get the Kagan nomination through. They didn't get the Disclose Act. And one Democrat whose future seems to be up in the air is the Honorable Charles Rangel, Democrat from New York.
As we do this podcast, Charles Rangel is in the final hours before the hearing where the charges against him are going to be made public, and where he is going to find out just exactly how deep he's in it and just how much this committee that's going to hear his case, conduct a trial, if you will, how much it has against him. That many people thought would never happen. They thought he would make a deal. They thought he would either resign or he would cop to some of the charges and maybe get some of the other ones dropped. But he's been adamant. He has been absolutely resolute about refusing to admit anything and refusing to resign.
There is tremendous pressure on him to do so. The Democrats, of course, came to power in 2006 on the culture of corruption issue, on the Republicans with Duke Cunningham and Jack Abramoff and
Mark Foley
and Bob Ney and Tom DeLay. And Nancy Pelosi said that she would drain the swamp of Washington corruption, meaning Republicans. And so Democrats don't want Charlie Rangel to be the poster boy of corruption in 2010 campaign. Now, he does say he will not resign. He does say he will intend to seek re-election. Two things, of course. Back in March, prior to resigning as chairman as of the Ways and Means Committee, he said he would never give that up. And for the most part, he really was stuck to his guns. But there is so much pressure from Pelosi on down, from the leadership, who say, look, we don't want to be saddled with this. And another problem, too, a lot of Democratic members of Congress who were elected from conservative districts.
The Blue Dogs.
Right. They don't want to have to defend Charlie Rangel. But at the same time, the Congressional Black Caucus, in light of what happened to Shirley Chiron, they said, look, we can't rush to judgment. Mm-hmm. Just because the charges are out there, just because somebody has made an allegation, doesn't mean the allegations are true, and we shouldn't rush like we did, like everybody did with Shirley Chiron.
That's right. But Shirley Chiron's speech, when heard in its entirety, was a complete defense. There was no question about the facts of that matter, and they're not in dispute, not anywhere you look. In contrast to that, what Charlie Rangel is being hauled before this committee for is income that he didn't report from a villa in the Dominican Republic.
Right.
That's a fact. The other thing is
the four rent-stabilized
apartments he supposedly needs in New York in violation of the law. These are facts. This is not something that is a matter of interpretation.
A corporate-paid junket to the Caribbean, which is against House rules.
Which is really what cost him the Ways and Means Committee chairmanship, not these other charges. But now these other charges are going to have to be, in some sense or another, faced, and they're going to have to be punishments. I don't see what he gains by trying to face down this committee and say, yeah, all right, well, that's all true. So what? That doesn't seem to me to be a winnable point for him. He's essentially proceeding on defiance.
Defiance is exactly the right word. The New York Times editorial the other day talked about this sense of entitlement that Charlie Rangel seems to have. And
after 40 years in Congress.
After 40 years in Congress. As a matter of fact, it was interesting that the statement he made the other day was at the Adam Clayton Powell building in Harlem.
The man he defeated in 1970.
And whose son he's running against in the September 14th primary.
Now, this son of his, Adam Clayton Powell IV, has been in the city council. He's been in the state legislature. He's also been in trouble a couple of times with accusations from women. He's also had run-ins with the law regarding driving and alcohol, charges that were knocked down and so forth to a lesser charge. He is not exactly a prize package either, and it doesn't look as though he's going to win his September primary against Rangel.
No, he actually ran against him once before in 1994 and got clobbered, like 62-30, something like that. And actually, there are three other candidates who are running against Rangel. The thing is, if Charlie Rangel admitted to these charges before the September 14th primary, it's possible that his nomination could be in jeopardy. What Charlie Rangel desperately wants to do, at the least, is prevail on September 14th, and then if he had to resign, the Democratic establishment there could pick a successor. But they couldn't do that if he loses the primary. So September 14th is a very key date for him.
So a lot of burdens here for the Democrats, a lot of weight for them to carry going into the fall campaign. Over on the Republican side, where they're pleased, obviously, to be watching all these travails for the Democrats, they are having some internal struggles of their own, some of which are caused by the very ferment within the party and within the party base. We've talked a lot about the Tea Party over the last year and a half, and the Tea Party is obviously fueling a lot of the enthusiasm, or it's feeding on a lot of the enthusiasm on the conservative side of the political spectrum. It's also generating a certain amount of controversy in and of itself. They've knocked off some people who looked like pretty strong candidates for statewide office in a few states. Now, Michelle Bachmann, the popular sort of Sarah Palin-style congresswoman from the Twin Cities area in Minnesota, has actually started a Tea Party caucus in the House, which seemed like a pretty logical idea. But that has set her up as a kind of spokesperson for a movement that previously did not have a clear spokesperson, and possibly to its benefit. And she's gotten into some trouble because of some candidates she's supporting in Missouri and New Jersey.
She has endorsed some mainstream Republican candidates, or certainly conservative, but perhaps too liberal for Tea Party regulars.
Well, they voted for the TARP program. They voted for the bailout of the banks in 08.
Like Roy Blunt in Missouri, for example. And that's what's going on here. There is even when Tom Tancredo, the former congressman who was very conservative.
He was very conservative.
I mean, very anti. I mean, everybody's anti-illegal immigration, but this guy made it as a cause. And that was
a crusade,
exactly right. So he announced that he's going to run for governor of Colorado as a third-party candidate on the American Constitution Party ticket. And the Tea Party people are blasting him for hurting the Republican Party, while at the same time, Tea Party people are campaigning against Lisa Murkowski, who is kind of a moderate conservative in Alaska, as a sellout, as a rhino. So there is so much disunity. You know, you could talk about Charlie Rangel and the scandals on the Democratic side, but there is so much disunity going on with the Republicans, even though everybody agrees that the Republicans are slated for sizable pickups in November, both in the House and Senate, and yet, you know, there's still a lot of turmoil going on in the GOP.
The Tea Party is also involved in the controversy and the fallout from the controversy over Shirley Sherrod, whom you mentioned earlier. There was that video of her giving the speech, only it was only about 8 seconds of the speech and gave a very misleading impression. That video came from a guy named Andrew Breitbart. I'm not sure we've talked about Andrew on the podcast.
I don't know if it came from him, but
he put it on his website.
Exactly, right.
Okay.
And, of course, this came after the NAACP blasted the Tea Party or elements of the Tea Party for racism. So Breitbart
was defending the Tea Party.
Basically, so the Tea Party comes full circle.
And saying it's really the NAACP that's racist. Now, Breitbart's standing, he was the guy, of course, who brought down the ACORN organization last year.
The video of Bob Etheridge, the North Carolina congressman, who was battling this young student on the streets of Washington. Now that we know of Breitbart's involvement, we don't know if that video was doctored either.
We remember, of course, also Breitbart was organizing those students who went into Mary Landrieu's office in New Orleans, tried to tap the phones in there, or at least in some sense or another, set up some kind of surveillance of how they were handling phone calls about the health care bill. So has Andrew Breitbart discovered that place where there's a little sign that says too far? Is there actually a place, even in today's media culture, where a source of video material, a source of stories, could actually have lost all his credibility?
Well, one would think so. And we have said about the Shirley Sherrod thing that everybody looked bad in it, the NAACP, the Obama administration, the Agriculture Department, the media outlets that ran it, and Breitbart. And yet, next month, at a fundraiser in Beverly Hills, California, Andrew Breitbart has been invited to appear with Michael Steele at a private Republican Party fundraiser.
And so if Michael Steele is still the chairman of the Republican National Committee at that time, he will be, in a sense, putting the official imprimatur of the party on Andrew Breitbart, would he not?
Why would they do that?
That's the question. We'll see if an answer emerges in later podcasts.
We're talking about Michael Steele's future, and that's later. I think we should talk about something that's sooner.
Would that be Oklahoma?
Oh, thank you for that segue,
Oklahoma. Okay, Oklahoma surprised some people by nominating not one, but two women for governor. The next governor of Oklahoma will be a woman.
The two candidates, Mary Fallon, the congresswoman who former lieutenant governor is a Republican nominee, and the Democratic nominee was more of a surprise. Jerry Askins, who is the current lieutenant governor, defeated Attorney General Drew Edmondson. One of these days, maybe years from now, speak of sooner or later, but one of these days we're going to stop talking about the fact that women are elected to office because men are always elected to office, but it's only like the third or fourth time in history that two women are running against each other for the office of governor.
New Mexico.
This year. Susana Martinez and Diane Dinesh, but also the first time was Kay Orr and Helen Bousalis in Nebraska in 1986.
The Orr-Bousalis race. You know, we could go on and on about the Orr-Bousalis race, which people remember more as the Bousalis-Orr race.
Well,
but we won't do that this week because we still need to talk about the upcoming primaries in three of my favorite states. In fact, one of my home states.
That would be Kansas.
That's right.
And the big Republican nomination there for the Senate that Sam Brownback is giving up to run for governor. Sam Brownback will likely be the next governor of Kansas. Todd Tehart and Jerry Moran, two conservative Republican congressman.
Couldn't ask for a better match between a conservative and a conservative, both of whom are saying the other guy isn't a conservative.
And they're screaming at each other, and the ads are saying that the two of them are fake, and they're sellouts, and they're backed by lobbyists, and it's very, very ugly. Now, in any other state, perhaps, personal attacks in a primary like this could help the Democratic Party, but since the Democrats last...
They would need to be a Democratic Party.
Well, since the last Democrat elected to the Senate in Kansas was 1932, I suspect that Jerry Moran, who I think is going to win it, Moran or Tehart, will be the next senator from Kansas. There's also a kind of a Republican primary going on in Missouri. We always thought Roy Blunt, the former minority and majority whip in the House, has the nomination locked up, and he still may.
He seemed to be the ideal candidate. Universal name recognition. His son has been the governor of the state.
The man has been.
And this was a guy who just seemed to be a pretty likely winner in November, although that's a contested race.
Robin Carnahan, the Democrat, Secretary of State there.
Yet it certainly seemed that he would have the Republican nomination wrapped up. But here again, a Tea Party favorite has emerged and actually is giving him a real run for it.
Yeah, I kind of think that, of course, you know, Blunt does win. He has more money, has all the endorsements. But I'd like to, it's very interesting to see how these disaffected conservatives are just, you know, rebelling against establishment choices. And certainly Roy Blunt is the establishment in Missouri.
Which is why he wanted to bring in Michelle Bachmann to burnish his own credentials on the Tea Party side. And we also have primaries in the very hard-hit state of Michigan.
Yeah, well, the Republicans are favored to take back the governorship. Jennifer Granholm is term limited, but there's a tough primary going on the Republican side. Peter Hoekstra, the congressman, is among those running. Mike Cox, the state attorney general, is running as well. Tough primary, but the Republicans are considered a slight favorite. And I think, given Governor Granholm's unpopularity and the situation with the economy, Republicans have to be favored in November.
Tough times for Democrats in Michigan, but good times for Democrats in Rhinebeck, New York this weekend. Our congratulations to Chelsea Clinton, who survived 8 years in the White House and an adolescence that must have been, shall we say, difficult.
Our best wishes to the Medvinskys and the Clintons.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron /Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Somebody's getting married. Somebody's getting married.
Somebody's getting married.
Somebody's getting
married. Somebody's getting.
Somebody's getting.
Somebody, 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 somebody.
Somebody get some flowers, somebody get a ring, somebody get a chapel and a choir to sing,
somebody get an organ to play,
cause somebody's getting married today.